Going live. And we are live. Welcome to the first ever Teaching Humans on Air talk. And so we thought to get things started, we would start with, or I would start with, having a talk with Nick about the WikiSeed project. It's kind of the thing that has moved a lot of things in my world. And I think the opportunity for us to just kind of chat about it, Nick, would be really good. So how you doing, Nick?
Doing well. And yourself?
I'm doing splendid. I feel really powerful and great. actually, I want to get right off starting. I think I want to jump not into what is the history of WikiSeed or kind of where did it come from. I think that's been told a lot. I'm interested where WikiSeed is right now.
Mm-hmm. So right now, it's in kind of it's in a really exciting place because there's lots of teachers who have, you know, used the project in their classroom in lots of very different ways. If there's one thing WikiSeed has, it's a diversity of uses. And most all of the teachers that have done it, they've had really good experiences with it. You know, it doesn't always start out really good. A lot of the teachers, or a lot of the initial reactions from students and other faculty and sometimes the students' parents even, oftentimes the reaction is kind of like, why are we building chairs? What does this have to do with math or science or American literature? But consistently, the teachers always have good experiences with it. And, you know, whether it's math or science or American literature, any of those classes, like, the project kind of works. And so we have this really, really strong community, a very diverse community. It's a global community that's, you know, teachers and students from kindergarten up through undergrad and college. And it feels like we're right on the edge, like right on the precipice of being able to jump into scaling this thing up so that it's really big and that everybody who wants to can have access to it. So the question now is, how do we scale it? I think, you know, I have no idea. I suspect that there isn't one right answer to it. I suspect that it's going to be a lot of different things that all just kind of help build on each other. But, you know, that's the question that's at the forefront of my mind right now.
Right. Yeah, and I know it's one we've been kind of thinking about here and there quite a bit. I want to go back to a moment you said, because I noticed it too when I was doing the WikiSeed project, is there's this initial hesitancy by the kids. There's always this kind of like, is this crazy? What am I doing? Why are we doing this? Why build a chair? And it does come up. I noticed it in quite a few of the times I've watched other classes do it. Why do you think that is? Why do you think something like this is so surprising to kids?
Well, I mean, I had the exact same reaction when you said that you wanted to do it with your American literature class. You know, and every time, even when I talk about it and share your story with other people, I find it difficult to explain what the connection is between American literature and building chairs. And I'll bet that every one of your students can probably explain it better than I can because they've experienced it. You know, I kind of have this secondhand experience of seeing the students go through and have that, you know, that realization that, like, all of this education, all the world, and like the things that we build and put into the world are all kind of connected in these unique ways, and they're connected in ways that are, you know, very profound and very personal. And so the only way to really understand that is to experience it. And I think that each one of your students that has done this, they totally get it. And so it's, you know, it's that thing that humans have always been grasping for. How do you share that feeling of experience with other people? I don't know. I think we just have to get more people to do it, or allow more people to do it, rather.
Right. So until it becomes normalized, right? There's something in thinking about, like, how does it apply to American literature, or, you know, in my instance, American literature. And it's funny to think that the project has nothing to do with American literature whatsoever. and it doesn't. It ostensibly doesn't. But where it fit in was in we hit a point, right, where like my students needed inspiration, and so we found it in Ralph Waldo Emerson. But then I also knew the whole time that my students would be writing. They'd be posting things, and I think that, you know, kind of worked into the, at least the language arts kind of standardsy things. So I've noticed people who start the project with students get discouraged the first time they put it in front of students, and it's funny to watch from kind of our perspective. People go through that first initial shock period is always kind of fun for me to watch. Talk to me, what do you think about the, we were watching some videos from Shanghai. Curtis Powell had done this in the school in Shanghai, and we were watching some of the videos, and we got on the phone or something after that and talked about the commonality of experience, the way that it doesn't matter what group of kids you put this thing in front of, they say the same things a lot of the time. So, Nick, what are those things that they say a lot, and why do you think they do?
It's fascinating how consistent the experience is across, you know, age, subject, focus, and also, like, cultural or geographic differences. Usually the first reaction is, why are we doing this? I don't really get it. And then there's a lot of unique experiences between those points. People often try and solve a problem, and so that if when you start solving a problem, first you have to identify the problem, which is, you know, you have to look at your local environment, and, you know, are you solving a problem for yourself? Are you solving a problem for somebody else? Oftentimes students will ultimately want to solve a problem for somebody else. And as soon as we start thinking about how to build something physical to solve a problem for somebody else, we have to start, you know, practicing empathy. We have to step into the other person's shoes and kind of imagine what that experience would be like, you know, for somebody else other than ourselves. And empathy is this fascinating thing that we talk about it a lot, but I wonder how often people actually practice it. And when you're building something for somebody else, you know, you don't really have much of a choice other than to practice it and imagine, you know, like literally put yourself in their shoes. Well, sometimes not literally wear their shoes. They might be different sizes or whatever, but, you know, go through their day and kind of like almost role play what that problem might be for the other person and have that conversation with that other person. And so that, the practicing of empathy is kind of a universal thing that all of the students go through at some point. And then also the feeling of, like, accomplishing something tangible, because so much of school is, you know, worksheets or rote memorization, and if you get the 100% A+, then you might put your test up on the fridge. Or, you know, I'm trying to remember, like, maybe you would put a worksheet up on the fridge if you're really proud of it. Probably not. But when people do this project, they have a physical, tangible thing, either, you know, for themselves or for somebody else. And so a lot of students take a lot of pride in that work. And frequently it's, you know, the class will organize an art gallery, and then they'll have that, you know, the pride of having something in an art gallery and being able to talk to the press and share it with the family, and then the family comes in and the teachers and the family and the students are all there, and, you know, they have that shared experience of celebrating the students' pride in what they've created, which is, it's really cool. Some students also have organized auctions around the seat to do fundraising, and then have that, you know, early taste of philanthropy and helping the bigger part of the world rather than just solving individual problems for individual people. How do you actually have impact on the larger world? And so some students have been doing that too. Have you noticed any other shared experiences that?
I think one I've heard a lot is when kids say something like, you know, this is really hard, but it's interesting. You know, yeah. You hear the kids comment on, like, the difficulty level, which is something I think when I hear students comment on the difficult, you know, when I usually hear kids comment on the difficulty of something, it's almost always like right before they quit.
Mm-hmm.
This is hard, followed by I quit. And it's interesting that this project, the people who do it, and you know, way more than students. I mean, I'm trying to build one myself, and there is this deep appreciation for how hard it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's something that, as a person who doesn't make a lot of things, I kind of took for granted. I know, in my own experience with building my wiki seat, I sat in front of my wiki seat recently for an hour and a half just trying to figure out, you know, how to bend the wood right. But I loved how hard it was, and you can hear that in what students say about the project or what people who do the wiki seat. They always have this, when they talk about how hard it is, it's never this negative, it's never a negative thing. And when I contrast that with how I hear that in school normally, I mean, mm-hmm. the results speak for themselves. So that's something I've heard a lot.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of it is, you know, the you can see a three-legged seat and you can, you know, envision what it would be like when it's finished. And so getting from point A to B is, you know, it's theoretically not difficult at all, but in practice it's, you know, it can be really challenging. But it's because it's so tangible and you can see the thing that you want to build in your mind. You know, it's, you can't give up on that if you can see it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you have to keep pushing it.
And so I think a while back you said something that has just stuck in my mind. You said that the catalyst, this bracket right here,
yep.
is a key that can be used to unlock anything. Or some, I think it was something like
right,
that.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if part of that, you know, that property of this catalyst is that it's easy to see where you want to go with it in the physical, tangible sense. And so you can use it as kind of this physical scaffolding for thinking through problems. You know, the more abstract problems, the intangible things. But you can kind of use the physical properties of the seat and the process of building the seat as a metaphor for solving whatever problem you try and unlock.
In almost anything, right? I mean, it really does lend itself to a lot of circumstances. And I think it's because it's authentic learning in a way that we don't get to experience a lot in any kind of formal setting. I think the whole thing is the whole, like, key to unlocking any door, it's just so amazing to me how many people have taken it so many different ways. really, I mean, when Curtis's students in Shanghai started outsourcing, or even when Curtis thought of the idea that they would outsource the work on the wiki seat,
uh-huh.
at first I was like, oh my God, this is a maker project. You can't, they got to make it. And then as Curtis and his students worked through it, I saw what he was doing. I saw he was teaching an intangible thing through this process, just like you said. And he was teaching them about production. He was teaching them about what it means to think about somebody as you design a project or a object.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's easier to delegate certain tasks in that process. So that was interesting to me. You know, and then it's been done in, like, science classes. And stuff. I don't know. It's so, you know, it's well beyond anything you and I ever thought. We talk about this every time we see each other. Like, it's well beyond what we would have thought. Do you have a favorite chair?
Oh, man, put me on the spot.
Yeah, like, do you have a favorite?
I tend to like the chairs where the students say, do we have to build a chair?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, regardless
of... You like the corner cutters. They're not the corner cutters, but, like, the people who play on the edges.
Yeah, the ones that are, you know, you've got this constraint. You've got one constraint. And they go and they challenge that constraint. And so some of my favorite chairs are, like, the puppet theater is definitely a good one. Because, you know... Who would think that this would result in a puppet theater? Some students did, and they built it. Some of the more, there's a really abstract one that came out of a class in Antonio's class. He's in Vancouver, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very abstract art. That's like this box on top of a tripod with some mirrors on it. I don't fully understand it, and I would like to, or maybe at least like to begin to understand it, but that's a good one.
Can it be sat in? I mean, does it work?
I don't think it would be good for anybody to sit in it. at that point, it would fall into the realm of performance art.
I think my favorite chair is, there's one that has a story to it that I don't want to tell the student's name because I'd embarrass her, but she had been in my class. It was the second year we did the Wiki Seats in my class, which was a very different experience than the first time. It was awesome, but it was weird to have kids who already had seen someone else do it pick up the project. It was different the second time, and a lot more fun, I think, the second time, for me at least, because I knew where it was going. But I had a student who, on the day the chairs were due, turned hers in, and she wouldn't take a picture next to it, and she didn't want me to photograph it. And I was like, well, come on. I mean, there's some really bad chairs here. Your chair is not any worse than somebody's in front of us. And we kind of laughed, and I said, just, you know, hey, stand there, let me take a picture next to it. And she said, I can't let you do that. And so I thought it was odd. And I talked to her after class and I said, what's the deal? She just said, I read all that stuff about Emerson last night. I know I should have read it earlier, but I just read it. And I know that I didn't do anywhere near what I could do. And if these chairs are about like who we are, then this chair isn't me. And I said, I was blown away. And I said, okay. And then like Monday, like 3 days later, she walks in with a totally different design for a chair that she'd worked on obviously all weekend. It was beautiful. It was a really nice chair. It showed me that the project meant more to her as a person than it did to either she or I as a school project.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know that was my favorite chair for that reason. You know, aesthetically, I like the Wiki Seat of Thrones. I thought that was pretty awesome. So, Nick, I'm going to I'm headed out to Shanghai to meet our friend William Hoy, and he's got the Maker Block going on out there in Singapore, and I think I have no idea how all of this came about. So could you tell me how you and William hung out and what happened that got me involved and suddenly I'm on a plane to the other side of the world?
Sure, yeah. So a few, maybe like 6 weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago, I went out to Shenzhen for Maker Faire. I work with this research group called the Institute for the Future, and we're looking at the future of the maker movement and what maker cities might be like. And so, you know, for a more global perspective, we flew out to Shenzhen to visit a maker fair that they have there and also get, you know, go and see some of the factories because Shenzhen is kind of this global center for electronics manufacturing. Foxconn's there, all of our iPhones are made there. There's this amazing Shanzai manufacturing kind of underground where they make all the knockoffs, which is pretty cool. And so, you know, after Maker Faire, we're visiting Seed Studio, which is a kind of an amazing electronics company that's building tools for makers or, you know, people with ideas for products or whatever. And they're also serving as kind of an interface for people with ideas to go and get an in to the Chinese manufacturing. So if you have a Kickstarter, for example, you can go and talk with Seed Studio and they'll help connect you to this vast resource to build things in the world. And we're getting to the point where pretty much everybody in the world has access to the tools to build anything and then scale it up so that everybody has access to that. So that's some context. After the tour of Seed Studio, we went down to the cafeteria and we were eating some food, and I sat down at a table with a guy who wrote the O'Reilly book on how to make wireless networked devices for the Internet of Things, and with William, who was a teacher with, he was a teacher at a school, but he seemed to be kind of dissatisfied with the way that school was going, and so he wanted to go and explore and kind of like, you know, reach outside the school walls and see what was going on, and he found himself at Maker Faire. And so he had this, you know, it seemed like it was a really good experience for him to see that there's all these different ways to learn, and we don't just have to learn in school. We don't have to, you know, have a textbook that shows the step 1, 2, 3, 4, memorize these things, complete the process, fill in the blank. You know, there's other ways out there to learn, and there's communities that are, like, practicing these new ways to learn. And so after a while, I was talking with William, and I shared the WikiSeed project with him, and I told him about your experience of kind of breaking outside that mold of the traditional learning models of memorizing stuff. And I think I introduced you guys on Twitter, and then you started talking on Facebook. And because the internet is totally amazing, and we have the ability to, you know, have this conversation over Google Hangouts or see somebody, like, have lunch with somebody in Shenzhen, China, and then introduce them to somebody in, you know, Cleveland, Ohio, and then you guys have never actually seen each other in person before, but we have the internet. And so, you know, I don't know, how much time have you guys spent together online talking about education?
A little bit. I mean, we're going to do 2 hours, 2 weeks almost together, and I think it's going to be great to go and experience their people who are involved in their education system. I mean, you know, they're no slouches. It's amazing what they have going over there, and their professional development and the way they approach teacher education is something that, you know, I would love for us to have. And so I'm hoping to gain a lot from just kind of interacting with educators, and then this maker movement as it keeps going global. You know, I always feel like the biggest imposter in any maker conversation because I don't consider myself handy with tools. I'm getting better.
You picked it up pretty quick, though.
I've welded. I've done a couple of things. But all within the last, you know, 2 years. But I think it's going to be so important to talk to people about the way that what's happening with makers in Singapore is a learning process more than a manufacturing process. Mm-hmm. I see it as a learning model way more importantly than I do see it as a manufacturing thing going on. And I really want to explore the conception and the perception of making and like the maker thing as it's playing out there, because it's manifesting itself in very different ways. You know, being here in the Midwest, to call someone a maker is almost like duh. It's what, you know, we're an industrial center of the country. All we've ever done is make things. You know, all of our grandparents were makers. Mm-hmm. And then I go out west and it's like very super techie. And when I went to the Maker Faire on the East Coast, it seemed very philosophical. So I look forward to going out there, and that connection with William is, I think you're exactly right. It's just, what a small world we've created for ourselves suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, go ahead.
It's a totally new world. We really never had this before.
Yeah, and I think what it does for learning, like to go back to the WikiSeed for a second, like, well, how did the Wiki, you know, I think about how the WikiSeed kind of broke out of its, you know, lecture hall 3 at Lakewood High School where I work. you know, it doesn't even live in Lecture Hall 3, and there is no such thing as that anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's this thing that's gone global, and I think it's because it's small enough to do so, right? I think as we begin to share ideas globally, it's probably best to speak in short sentences. you know, metaphorically, that when I think of, when people talk about like online learning, and it's almost always with the word massive in front of it, right? Massive online learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want us to think about challenging that idea and making things that are small that can easily be transferred across the internet, like the designs for the catalyst for the WikiSeat.
Yeah.
You know, the WikiSeat isn't like an entire unit plan. It's like a part of something you're going to do that fits something else you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helps it transfer as well.
Did you ever see that Star Trek episode that was Darmak and Jalad at Tanagra?
No, but please tell.
All right, it's a good one. I highly recommend Googling it. So it's a TNG episode where you know, Picard and everybody on the ship go and run into this alien race, and they're only capable of speaking in very shorthand references to cultural events.
Huh.
And there's a lot of really fascinating, I don't know if we can call it research, there's some blog posts written on it, but it's comparing that Star Trek episode to how we use memes to communicate. So you, those little pictures with like a cat or a sloth or, you know, a bear or whatever, and text. You can't possibly fit more than a sentence because you have to have the picture in the middle. And so I wonder, like, it's a really good format for communicating online. And I wonder if maybe, I don't know, I've never really thought about this before, but what does education look like if it's structured in the meme format?
Yeah. Oh, I think it gets better and cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, I think about this, you know, obviously, I think this is something I think about a lot. We can have distributed classrooms. I mean, the only reason we all meet up together in some local middle space is because that's where all the smart people hung out. You know, like, we would always have to go to where the smart people were. If it was Socrates, it'd be on his front stoop, you know. And if it was Einstein, you had to go to the, you had to go where he was presenting at. Now, with it being as distributed as it is, there is no reason whatsoever for distance or place to play much of a role in learning anymore.
Right.
No, I mean, now all learning is local, right? I mean, it has to have immediate context for the learner. It has to be real to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we should be able to toss around really small packets of information, you know, meme-like, much better than we can, like, Coursera or, like, this massive, like, here, take my big product, or here's my online learning platform.
Right.
I think it'd be so much easier to make, like a universe of small learning objects.
Mm-hmm.
And let them float freely like a meme does, right? Let them kind of spread the way they do. Like, the WikiSeat has spread so perfectly, you know, with, like, no real, I mean, there's no, or, there's no real organization behind it. it's founded on a principle, right? Like, share it, share it, share it, and share it.
Yeah. And every person that starts participating in it, you know, by the very nature of the project, you can't help but share it. And so whether that's with your local community offline, or it's, you know, writing a blog post or putting stuff on Twitter, like, everybody that participates in the project becomes, like, an equal participant in the, I don't know, the marketing of the project, to use one of those old world words.
Yeah, it's definitely like a word of mouth kind of thing.
Yeah. And it makes it gives people, like, everybody has equal ownership in the thing. There's no single person driving it. Like, I'm certainly not driving it. I don't think you are. It's collectively everybody that does whatever they do with it.
Right. I mean, I'm talking about it a lot, but only because I'm still so blown away by it. And it's popping up. Like, you know, like, you'll look away from it, and all of a sudden someone in, you know, somewhere else in the world is going to be doing it. It's pretty neat. It's pretty neat. And I appreciate that, you know, you kind of thought it up. And the whole story is interesting. If people want to check it out, they really should. Let's go off the WikiSeat for a minute.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on education as a person who's kind of come into it from a design? You're kind of thrust into the education conversation. I kind of threw you into the middle of a whirlwind. In thinking about education, I'm sure you hadn't really dealt with it like that before. What are your thoughts? What have you noticed about the process and the structure of it all?
Oh man, put me on the spot again. So the reason I find the whole education conversation fascinating, because I was very recently a student put through the education system, and I absolutely loved school, but not in the way that the education system is built. Like, you know, the experience that I got wasn't because that is how the education system was designed. And
you kind of hacked it.
Yeah, and like, you know, in college, for example, I went and took a couple of the general education courses, you know, the first entry-level math and the bio, and I dropped out of those classes because I had already done that. And I went and talked to my advisor, and I was like, hey, I need this bio credit, but I already know all this stuff from this bio class, so is it okay if I take this 600-level sociology or entomology of social insects class? That's, you know, and she said, sure. And I think that, you know, a lot of students go through all of school just thinking that school is this rigid thing, and there's this general education curricular, there's this core standard, and you're supposed to have teachers kind of structure all of the learning around that, and then the kids have to accept that structure and then do things to meet those standards or that curriculum. I think that's the conversation that educators are having right now, and that's very different than my experience with school. I think school should be this kind of like, you know, modular thing that's meant to be taken apart and reassembled in different ways. I was fortunate enough to go to a high school, a public high school, that had a really good art program, and we had, you know, three different technology classes and architecture and design. Yeah.
Where did you go?
Dublin, Scioto. Yeah, it's a suburb outside of Columbus, Ohio. So I had a great experience because those resources were available, and I figured out a way to, you know, mostly just take the art and design classes that I wanted to take. But I'm starting to realize that a lot of students just straight up don't have that opportunity. Something like 75% of the shop classes in California have been cut since the 80s. And if I had to go through high school without having shop classes or art, I definitely would have dropped out.
Really?
Oh yeah. Regular school's total BS.
Yeah.
No offense. But it's, you know, it's not fun.
It wasn't your thing, right?
So I wonder, you know, I've been to a couple education conferences now, and you know, there might have been one or two students there that were talking about what they wanted. But it's, I wish there was more of that, and I wish there was more about the, you know, the hands-on aspects of education, because there's, you know, there's, how many learning types are there? Like four? There's like kinesthetic and verbal and...
Yeah, right.
I think school is almost entirely built around the logical writing one. And we're only supposed to be thought workers and think about things in the abstract, and, you know.
It's the whole abstract thinking thing that drives me nuts, right? I mean, that's the thing that kills me, is like this whole, like, every new school has to be called an academy. And, you know, I mean, what do academies do? But think, you know, I want to teach people to do and live.
Right.
Thinking is cool, but and you got to be good at it. And, you know, no matter what you are, you want to be the smartest at it. But... yeah, I run up against that all the time. I think it's a tough one.
And I think that any thought that anybody has, you know, it really has to be grounded in something. You can't just think abstractly, because the root of that thought might be totally flawed, and you might live your entire life without ever realizing that. So, you know, but if you have tangible physical things that you're thinking around, and you try it and experiment with it and expect the first 100 experiments to fail, and then there's that one that kind of works, then, you know, from that success, you can start philosophy or something. But, yeah, jumping right into theoretical doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and you got to build from it. Kind of the last thing.
I love theory, but, you know.
Right. No, yeah, it's fun to think about, especially later in the evening.
Right.
Theory's great, you know, theory's great at, you know, 11:30. Or one.
So I'm gonna turn this question back around. What do you think about the conversation in education right now? Because you're actually in it. You're an educator. You've worked in schools for a long time.
I think we're really dangerously close to, you know, there's a James Brown song called "Talking Loud and Saying Nothing." it feels like sometimes especially when I'm online. That the conversation has been taken over by people who want to talk about standards, and like, it's like everyone found a new tool, and all they want to talk about is what we're told to talk about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like what Twitter has become in a lot of ways to me right now is like the world's largest staff meeting. It's just a distribution and handing out of materials. I mean, it's almost Dante-esque. This like. Constantly like trading back and forth of materials, and you know, here are 10 ways to teach the Common Core and 6 ways to win at the park test.
Sure.
And as an educator who's kind of on the front of it, I want the conversation to be about what I see in front of me right now, which mm-hmm. is, you know, heads on desks. It so clearly isn't working for kids. You know, I mean, like you said, you want to hear more student voices. I do too. I think they're the ones who can really tell us how it is right now and what we should be talking about. I don't think most parents and kids, if they found out how many hours educators talk about testing and performance goals and measurement and, you know, we have teachers who run around now saying, I love data. I love data. I love kids. I love learning. I don't love data. I don't love the Common Core. I don't love the PARC test. And I want the conversation in education to be a little bit different. That being said, I really love the way that educators are using the internet right now to talk to one another. Like, you know, I might critique what they say, you know, in a large sense, but you know, it's always true of everybody, I guess. The people I hang out with online are really cool. you know, my bias is clear. You know, I find stuff online all the time, and I can't believe that educators are sharing as much as they are and are being as honest as they are in some places. I mean, there's people like Audrey Waters and Gary Steger who I think sometimes seem angry, but as I listen to what they're talking about, it's got to be hard to be people who shout against 25 other people shouting louder than you.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to get frustrating to be a person with a voice that's strong but, like, drowned out by, like, millions of, you know, should we implement the Common Core this month or next month? You know,
right.
It's just silly. So, I mean, that's I'm pretty jaded on that conversation.
Now that we're talking about the internet, what are your thoughts on using the internet as a tool in education? Because, you know, like, some teachers don't allow students to look at Wikipedia. Or, you know, social media is blocked in a lot of schools.
I think it's the silliest thing I ever heard. It's like not using electricity. I insist that we all use candles.
Right.
Use that hand crank. We don't need that cord. That screw, you know, the cordless drill or whatever. I think it was an initial reaction of fear by teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Fear that what we were experts at wasn't the thing that people considered to be the most important thing in learning. You know, I mean, I'm of a generation. I'm 41 years old. I have only been teaching since I was 30. But even then, like the schools I went to didn't – I became a teacher to be an expert at the old kind of school. you know, I was, that's what I wanted to do in my life.
Yeah.
I had no way of knowing that the internet would do what it's done.
And it seems like right now students are being students to become experts in the old industrial style, you know, business world, which is, you know, I don't know how much longer that's going to last, but it doesn't look like it'll be around forever.
Yeah, maybe it's time for us to cut out the business metaphors, right? Expand the business bay, because it's not going well for a lot of them.
Right.
Yet every day, you know, hundreds of thousands of students are told school is your job, grades are your paycheck, this is your assignment, this is your task, don't be late, punch in. We really have used this business model for something that's really an art. And it's not only so much an art as it's like a naturally occurring human instance. Like, you know, humans left totally alone will learn very well. And for some reason, we seem to want to insert ourselves into the learning, but not as like provokers of it, but measurers of it. You know, there's a sense to me that like, we're running behind kids with rulers, trying to measure every single thing they do, forgetting the whole time that we could be running alongside of having a blast.
Mm-hmm.
In running towards, you know, whatever.
So you seem to be coming down on data.
Yeah, okay.
But last time, a while back, you know, you invited a couple of people out to Cleveland to talk about education.
Uh-huh.
And we had a conversation about data. And could you say a little bit about what that conversation was?
Yes. You were great. yes. I always have this knee-jerk reaction against data and its uses. But when everyone came to the Cleveland Summit, we had this conversation, well, not really a conversation, it was me blurting out how much I hate data, and then having a room of 7 or 8 people who I admire most in the world in education tell me, shut up, idiot. And what I came to understand in that conversation was that maybe it's not the data, that the love of data that's the problem, it's the love of what I see as not very good data. Mm-hmm. And then we talk about this incredible idea of what if we gave the world all the data in an education in a school, you know, and we start talking about this idea of having a scoreboard. Remember, it's like 10-foot by 20-foot humongous board that would have
yeah.
a digital board that would have like how many kilowatts we did used and how the reduction in the students we got students to quit driving to school,
mm-hmm.
or how many miles have we walked, and really just go like data absurd.
Yeah, and like some of my favorites were how many new projects have you started, or how many ideas have you had, and how many things have you given us on?
Away from the building, right?
Yeah, and surrendering the metrics over to the student, so the student can ultimately measure anything they want.
Right, and there's tons of research that says when you do that for students, I mean, things work out better for them. You know, just like for us, you know, I mean, we all set our own bars. And mm-hmm. students should be involved in kind of setting bars for themselves. I mean, like a regular practice. And we could get there. I think we can get there a lot. Well, look, I think we are very close to the end. We've been talking for 45 minutes. That's a long time. And I'd like to thank you for, I don't know, this whole experience. This whole WikiC thing has been neat. And I just have so much fun going, you know, every time something pops up, you and I connect like this, and it's great to have a chance to talk more about it. And, you know, the next problem is scaling.
Yeah.
And we got to figure it out. You know, I'm thinking that I want to go to people who teach welding and just say, hey, when you teach welding, could you teach how to make this?
Yeah.
Know, there would be just like a surplus of them. Or I want to go to makerspaces and say, could everyone, if you're running a welding class, make this?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of use it as the elementary tool for learning spot welding. Like, it's the thing you make to show that you can spot weld.
Yeah.
And with making the catalyst the assessment, you also then automatically have a catalyst to make it see. And that can be given to people, right? Because all the welders don't want to make the seats. But those can be given away. We could have maker spaces just as you learn, as you do welding classes, everyone throws their catalysts in a bin. And at the end of the month, that maker space mails out that bin or goes over to their local school and hands it to them.
This is awesome. Let's do it.
So that's when I think I wrote an email that, like, I want to make making the catalysts fun.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a way to do it, is just to get people randomly making catalysts to learn welding.
And when you weld, you have to find a thing to practice on, and usually that's just thrown back into the scrap bin. So, you know, right. You're never going to put the practice weld up on the refrigerator.
And
but
if
you actually create something useful and you give it to somebody, then
yeah. Yeah, I think it's a way. You know, I mean, does it solve everything? Does it scale the whole thing? No way. But you know, it's one of those things that I think everyone could just, if you can weld, you can make a catalyst. And if you can make a catalyst, you can change a kit.
Mm-hmm. And all the instructions are on the internet, so anybody can have the information, the access to this, and start their own community.
Right.
So, yeah.
See, it's already scaled. It's just on the internet.
Yeah. It's there. So I have one last question for you.
What?
This podcast hangout, is there another one? Are you going to start doing these regularly every other day?
I would like to maybe do one of these a week or when I can. What I wanted to do with this whole thing is I talk to so many interesting people, and I feel like I'm so lucky to do that, and then I always want to have an opportunity to share some of these conversations I'm having with people, with more people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last 3 years, I've just met some amazing folks, and I wanted to start with you because I think you've had the most impact on my work. But yeah, I look forward to, I want to get William Hoy on here, and I want to get him on with James Carlson. This is my thing I'm thinking of next, is James Carlson and William Hoy have not met, and I would like to keep it that way until I introduce them here. And I would love to do, I've been thinking of, like, different things we can do on this on-air thing. It would be great to kind of throw together three people who haven't met,
mm-hmm.
and just watch them kind of have a discussion. Just being interesting people. Like, when we had the Cleveland Summit, so we call it the Cleveland Summit kind of jokingly, but we had Nick Weidegger, Stephanie Chang, Sean Cornally, James Carlson, and Shelley Blake Plock here to Cleveland, and I was asked at one point, like, what's the agenda? And I was like, are you kidding me? Just get those people in the room and watch, you know, and watch what happens and then interact with that. And sure enough, that's all the agenda we needed. I think we could have a summit of those same seven or eight people once a year and make it a highlight of our year for sure.
Yeah, that was a fun time.
This will be infrequent. I mean, it won't be every day for sure, but I think it should be something that I start doing on Teaching Humans as I kind of take it into this next phase. So we'll see where it goes. And maybe it'll be Google Hangouts, maybe it'll be something else. I don't know what the format will be, but this has been fun.
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
Definitely tune in next time.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nick.
Good to talk to you, as always. And thanks for keeping the ball rolling on this whole crazy idea.
I mean, we're just trying to keep it going. We'll see what happens.
All have right. A good one.
Yep.